The following preview is of a graphic audio production rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Deathlands Number 2, Red Holocaust. It is the late 21st century, and Russia has become even more of a nightmare than the Deathlands, with roving bands of marauders bent on raping and pillaging every town they come across.
You can't take our food! We are all poor!
He is poor no more, my brothers and sisters. Let us go now to his filthy town and help them all to escape from poverty.
While in the nuke-blasted hell of the former state of Alaska, Ryan and his band have come across a startling secret pre-dark outpost run by a crazed old man.
I'm Quint, the keeper of the redoubt, and my word is law, and the law is death. I had to kill your friend.
And yet they also find time to take pleasure in their new surroundings.
This path feels incredible.
How does this feel?
But the horrors of the Deathlands aren't avoided for long.
Blessed are the nukes!
And blessed shall be the fallout!
For we await thy black visage.
Amen!
And Ryan and JB must face the wrath of the Russian marauders when they invade the Deathlands.
You're wasting your time torturing me. We aren't gonna give you our guns.
Perhaps. But do not worry. The time will not be wasted.
Deathlands 2, Red Holocaust. 7 unabridged hours in graphic audio. The movie in your mind. A generation after a global nuclear war, Ryan Cotter and his intrepid team of travelers discover that Louisiana is now a fetid, sullen landscape of impenetrable swamps and grotesque mutations. In this reeking swampland that was the Mississippi Basin stands Baron Tormand's voodoo temple, where human sacrifice is practiced. Girls are slaughtered, children are defiled, the dead are made to live, and the living are made to die.
I sense that strangers come, Baron Tourmont. They are not as we are. Not Cajuns. Not your men or women. Not the wolf's head renegades. They have come from nowhere.
And the signs are bad?
As bad as can be. They come! They come!
Deathlands Number 3, Neutron Solstice.
Nuke blasting. We killed them. How the hell are they getting back up?
Finn, look out!
By the three Kennedys.
I want the strangers dead. Track them and take them. That's all. But bring me the women alive.
No! No!
I have the Earth power. And I swear by Gaia that if you harm her, I'll kill you.
You dare to threaten me? You're big for death when I'm through with you.
You'll need everything you got to go up against him.
Also have some kind of jelly gas. That help?
What is that stuff?
By the three Kennedys. That, gentlemen, is napalm.
Shit.
Don't miss Deathlands Number 3, Neutron Solstice. The battle for the bayou has begun.
Graphic audio. A movie in your mind.
Two centuries after Skydark,
Earth remains chained to a sinister destiny spawned by hybrids and human traitors, manipulating humankind from deep inside the chaos of forgotten worlds. Once stone-cold protectors of the ruling order, Kane, Grant, and their compatriots from Cerberus Redoubt strike back against the tide of extinction which threatens to sweep away the human race in conflicts with no boundaries in time, space, or reality. Together, they battle for humankind's liberty and the hope of a restored and peaceful world.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Outlanders. Narrated by Terrence Aselford. With performances by Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, Jeff Baker, Christopher Graybill, Timberly Chanel, Kate Torrey, and Colleen Delaney. Outlanders number 28, Mad God's Wrath.
A silence as deep and still as the white pumice deserts of the moon's Mare Imbrium draped the tomb of McCann. When Eduardo Vega caught that singularly sepulchral concept sinking through his consciousness, he tried to stomp on it and crush it out. The big vault-walled room was not a tomb, he told himself fiercely, only a storage chamber. The starshine flowing down from a round skylight in the high arched roof proved that without a doubt, even though it glinted dully on two objects resembling high-tech Egyptian sarcophagi. The filtered illumination struck highlights on the stacked metal crates and the hand tools scattered atop the long trestle tables. Most of the crates were stenciled with the legend NASA, and a few others read Devil Menetius Base. Pieces of machinery lay scattered on the floor. Various areas around the warehouse were piled with debris, separated by their materials for future recycling. The walls, ceiling, and floor of the storage chamber formed one continuous surface to make a huge, hollow ellipse that measured out to 100 feet in diameter. When in it, Eduardo always felt as if he were trapped within the center of an impossibly gargantuan ball. From the curving walls of the chamber jutted platforms connected by a series of cage-enclosed lifts and crossed girders. Tall, Y-shaped induction pylons sprouted from the floor, but their ceramic surfaces were blackened with soot. Between two of the pylons, there stood a pair of oblong pedestals nearly 7 feet long. Four small pyramids, crafted from pale golden alloy, were placed at equidistant points around them. Resting on pedestals were smooth, crystalline ovoids made of translucent materials, both of which canted at 45-degree angles. Moving off the stool where he had half-dozed for the better part of an hour, Eduardo wiped his eyes with the heel of his left hand. From his right wrist, a radiophone dangled by a leather strap. He squinted up at the skylight. Space looked unchanging. The deep, jet-black emptiness, alleviated only by the bright, tiny pinpoints of stars, was the canopy of eternity overhanging the Menetius moon base. He snorted at his own poetic turn of thought.
Eduardo! Goddamn you, Eddie!
Eduardo winced at Morissette's tone as he thumbed the transmit key.
I'm here, Gabe. What's your problem?
You're 10 minutes overdue for your check-in. If I come down there and find you asleep again...
You'll what? Court-martial me? No, wait. You can't do that, because I'm a civilian, just like you are. Exile me to Earth? Oh, that would be a fucking shame, wouldn't it? I couldn't pull guard duty in these lovely surroundings anymore. Oh, boo-hoo. That would just shatter me.
You drew the short straw this week, Eddie.
Don't remind me. I just don't see any point in posting guards here. That elf-eared son of a bitch isn't going anywhere.
You know damn well we're not worried about him going anywhere, but keeping somebody else from coming along to fetch him to wake him up is the mission statement.
Oh, please. Saladin is dead. If Mac has any followers left, they're out scrounging in the wildlands. They wouldn't come back here.
That's why we post guards, dumbass. To make sure they won't come back. I'm tired arguing with you. Just be a little more on the ball when the next check-in time comes around.
For a moment, Eduardo wrestled with the urge to reestablish radio contact just so he could tell the man to kiss his ass, both in Spanish and French. The urge passed, and Eduardo began to make a circuit of the room, trying to work a kink out of his back in the process. As he passed one of the stasis canisters, he caught his own reflection in the rounded crystalline cover. He glimpsed a middle-aged man, slightly below medium height, wearing a dark brown coverall. His complexion was of a similar hue, and his long black hair framed a deeply scarred face. He glanced over at the second cryostasis canister and repressed a shiver. Eduardo found himself mentally identifying the chamber as a tomb and the canister as a coffin, although neither one was truly intended for such use. The big room was little more than a warehouse, holding the odds and ends left over from the construction of the moon base 2 centuries earlier. The colony wasn't much to see, but it represented 20-some years of tremendous labor, conducted largely in secret between the 1970s and the late 1990s. Most of the base had been hollowed out of the rock of the regolith, the inner wall of the Menetius crater. A network of conduits and ventilation shafts supplied air to most of the colony, and machines called gravstatters transmitted Earth-normal gravity fields. Out on the flat plateau, on the floor of the crater, a sprawling solar power station had been built. This was an arrangement of metal frames holding reflective semiconductor chips that stored and converted solar energy to electricity. Much of the solar power was directed toward the big hydroponic gardens enclosed within the main part of the base. The individual sections were roofed with domes of transparent plastic. Plants of all kinds grew in beds of fertilized soil. For many years, the vegetable gardens had served as the source of most of the food for the colony. Eduardo swallowed a sigh, thinking back to the long months he had lived on the lunar colony before entering cryostasis to relieve some of the strain on the base's limited resources. After the nuke cost of 2001, the 330 human beings stationed in the Menetius crater were forever separated from the world of their birth and had no choice but to make the colony self-sustaining. At first, the base personnel fabricated everything they needed, or they had tried to do so. Fortunately, even before the nuke cost, rich veins of gold, copper, and iron ore had been discovered and mined in areas outside the Menetius crater. Then other items had been found, and the reasons to continue with the manufacturing process had become less immediate. Thinking about those other items caused the flesh between Eduardo's shoulder blades to prickle. At the faint scuff of a footfall, he whirled, every nerve end tingling. Someone was walking down the narrow passageway just outside the open hatch. Swiftly, he returned to his stool, reaching for the pulse plasma emitter leaning against the bulkhead. The weapon, known colloquially as a quartz cremator, looked like the skeleton of a rifle made of polished glass overlaid with ceramic. The sectionalized barrel terminated in a long cylinder made of a crystalline substance. He cradled it in his arms as the footsteps grew louder. Despite realizing that whoever strode down the corridor wasn't making any effort to be stealthy, a sense of imminent peril crept over Eduardo. He rested his fingers on the firing plate just as a figure appeared in the hatchway.
Shit! For God's sake, Eddie!
Jesus Christ!
George Newkirk gaped at the quartz cremator with wide, alarmed eyes.
For God's sake yourself, George! What the hell are you doing here? I thought you were down in Cerberus.
Newkirk nodded and stepped farther into the room, his eyes darting nervously from Eduardo to the pulse plasma emitter. He was a short, chunky man with seamed, weather-beaten features and a white crew cut. He wore a gray, zippered coverall cinched at the waist by a wide leather tool belt. Wrenches and various sizes of screwdrivers dangled from it.
I'm up here servicing a replacement TAV. One of the two Mantas flown to Cerberus was shot down over India a couple of weeks ago, remember?
Right. Grant was the pilot.
Just figured I'd stop by and say hello before I gated back. Thought you might want some company.
Well, thanks, but I've got company. Mac over here is a great conversationalist.
He did have the gift of gab.
Eduardo walked toward the unit.
Beats me why Kane doesn't just drag this thing out to the surface and open it up. Mac wanted to die anyhow.
There was some discussion along those lines, but everybody thinks Mac might be a good source of information, providing he can be controlled.
Eduardo nodded distractedly, stopping beside the sarcophagus. Beneath the crystal cover, it seemed filled with a cloudy substance like smoke that had been frozen in mid-swirl. He touched the transparent surface, and the vapor within the ovoid immediately cleared. Within it appeared McCann, his long fingers curved like talons, the tips flattened against the inside of the lid. His eyes wide and wild, but unseeing. His expression was locked in a contortion of fury. All the color seemed to have been leached from his body. His form had the appearance of pale blue ice, not only in color, but composition. Even a spattering of blood on the side of his face was black, like splashes of ink. The blood had trickled from a wound Kane had inflicted. Eduardo could see that McCann, even lying half-prone, was a little over 6 feet in height, but so exceptionally lean he appeared even taller. Absently, he noted that the man's torso seemed strangely elongated, but perfectly in proportion with his slender arms and legs. His limbs were encased in a black, skin-tight covering, and an assortment of brightly colored cloths decorated his almost emaciated frame, giving him a scarecrow-like appearance. A yellow rag around his hips served as either a sash or a belt, and another length of bright green fabric was knotted around his left thigh for no apparent purpose. McCann's face was long and bony, his chin a jutting V under the smaller V of his pursed lips. His long, narrow nose looked delicate with tiny nostrils. His eyes were abnormally large and backslanted, but without the epicanthic folds of the Asian. Because of the polarizing effect of the stasis chamber, Eduardo couldn't tell their color, only that they were dark. His smooth skin was marred by a curve of scar tissue along his right cheek. The man's unnaturally long fingers bore many sigil and talismanic rings. One was a loop of iron embossed with a cup and spiral glyph. Another glittered with a hexagonal red stone. Each ring was fashioned from a different substance, crystal, metal, gems, and even what looked like polished lacquered wood. A mane of iron-gray hair grew outward from a point on his forehead and swept down from high, flat temples. It was brushed back behind his ears to fall in a loose tumble around his shoulders. McCann's ears were positioned very low on his jawline, and though they lay close to the sides of his head and weren't large, they tapered to upswept points.
"Sometimes I wonder if we weren't better off not re-establishing contact with Earth."
Eduardo moved his hand from the humped crystal cover, and the smoky vapor within it immediately swirled around the figure of McCann again, obscuring it from view. The stasis unit was an encapsulated survival system that froze a subject in an impenetrable bubble of space and time, slowing to a stop all metabolic processes. He grasped only a little of the technology involved, but he knew it was of extraterrestrial origin.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean..."
Newkirk whipped up his hand. It held a pistol.
"Knowing about post-nuke Earth put all sorts of ideas in my head. Like how to get the hell away from it."
Eduardo's thought processes felt paralyzed, numbed by bewildered shock when he finally realized the rail pistol gripped in Newkirk's hand was trained on him. The pistol held the general configuration of a revolver, but instead of a cylinder, a small round ammo drum was fitted into the place where there would normally be a trigger guard. The gun had no trigger, just a curving switch set into the grip. The slender barrel stretched to nearly 10 inches in length. Made of a lightweight alloy resembling dulled chrome, the rail pistol utilized a system of tiny electromagnets to launch an explosive projectile of tungsten carbide at a fantastically high muzzle velocity. A unit of energy inside the grip propelled the projectile out of the barrel at a speed of nearly 15 miles per second. In a vacuum, the velocity would be closer to 35 miles per second with absolutely no recoil. Eduardo was intimately and uncomfortably familiar with the destructive effects of the long-barreled hand weapons. Not too long ago, he'd used one of the rail guns to destroy a marauding Carnobot.
"What the fuck is this about, George?"
"Drop the cremator, Eddie."
Eduardo hesitated for only a second. He dropped his emitter to the deck. Responding to a gesticulation of the rail pistol's barrel, he stepped away from it.
"Why are you doing this?"
Newkirk grinned, showing the edges of his teeth.
"I'm asserting myself. I've been one of McCann's people for months, nearly a year."
"McCann's a maniac, George. He wanted to kill himself and take the whole damn solar system with him."
"But since the Devil platform imploded, he probably won't be so fixated on suicide."
"So what do you want to do, give him a hobby?"
"We have something ready to occupy his attention."
"We? Why have you hooked back up with those idiots who believe he's a god?"
"He's not a perfect god, I'll admit. But he's about the most reasonable facsimile I'm liable to run into in my lifetime."
Eduardo squeezed his eyes shut, feeling terror knot in the pit of his stomach like lengths of slimy rope.
"Mac is just as likely to tear your eyes out as thank you if you revive him. What can you gain from freeing him? He wants followers, not colleagues."
"There are less worthy pursuits for someone of my intelligence and talent."
"Name two, Georgie."
"I've only got time for one. Goodbye, Eddie."
Arms and legs flailing, blood foaming from his mouth in a crimson fountain, Eduardo Vega flew nearly half the length of the chamber and almost through the hatch. He struck the deck with a wet slap, his body twisting and writhing, legs kicking feebly. His legs were still twitching in post-mortem spasms when seven people strode into the storage facility, all of them looking around alertly. They wore steel-gray armored EVA suits, known in the old NASA vernacular as hard suits. Designed for high-impact resistance to deflect the penetration of micrometeorites, the extravehicular activity suits were the late 20th century versions of medieval battle armor. However, none of the people who marched into the warehouse, four men and three women, wore the helmets. They paid no attention to Eduardo's corpse except to shift position to keep from bloodying their boots in the dark, wide pool spreading out around his body. A woman marched up to Newkirk.
You sure you know how to operate these units, George?
I'm not like you, Shade, or the rest of your crew. I was born in a world of technology, so I don't fear it as something arcane I can never master. Besides, keep in mind, I was in cryostasis myself for most of my 200 years on this turd ball.
Shade stiffened at the patronizing bite in Newkirk's response. Nearly a full head taller than Newkirk, she was a good deal leaner and stronger of limb as well. Her angular café au lait face was set in a grim mask, her long, yellow-streaked hair tied up in a knot atop her head. Her large, pewter-colored eyes regarded him unblinkingly. Faint scars showed on the left side of her face, one of them bisecting her eyebrow. A 10-inch Bowie knife lay in a canvas scabbard across her belly. The square butt of a gyrojet rocket pistol protruded from the top of a vacuum-formed plastic holster attached to the right thigh of her spacesuit. The pistol looked like a toy made of stamped tin, but it fired 13-millimeter rocket rounds. The percussion primers of the projectiles were surrounded by a ring of four canted exhaust ports that propelled the round. The gyrojet was a weapon perfectly suited for combat on the surface of the moon, inasmuch as its range and penetration power were far greater than those of a standard firearm in an atmosphere. Shade nodded curtly toward the sarcophagus holding McCann.
Prove it.
She didn't need to suggestively finger the butt of her pistol to emphasize the request. The cold gleam in her eyes was only slightly less subtle than a direct threat. Feeling his throat constrict from tension, Newkirk slid the railgun back into his tool belt and turned toward the canister. He bent and felt around the base. He found the tiny inset keypad and tapped in a sequence. The smoky vapor beneath the crystal cover suddenly began to swirl and billow. A second later, it disappeared completely, as if it had been sucked into a vent and ejected. The transparent sheathing suddenly split in two, the halves sliding apart and withdrawing into a pair of almost invisible slots. A blue-hued light shimmered from within the stasis canister. Shade stepped forward, eyes reflecting the light rapidly.
What's happening?
Before Newkirk could respond, a lean figure sprang out of the sarcophagus as if launched by a catapult. It roared in blind, mindless fury, eyes gleaming with the color of freshly spilled blood. Shade and her companions dropped to one knee, bowing their heads in reverence. After a numb handful of seconds, Newkirk did the same, surreptitiously peering upward as McCann swept a wild, disoriented glare around the warehouse. Newkirk felt cold sweat spring out on his hairline as the burning scarlet eyes fixed on him. McCann, the last of the Tuatha De Danann, the mad god of the ancient Celts, reached out a long arm toward him, fingers stretching wide to encircle his neck. An animalistic growl hummed in his throat.
You better start talking about this mirror matter theory of yours, George, and make it damn fast.
McCann heard the woman's words, and his hand froze inches from Newkirk's neck. The red flame in his eyes dimmed slightly. He tentatively touched the wound on the right side of his head.
What's that again? Mirror matter.
Cain awoke to the squawk of birds, the nostril-clogging smell of decay, and an excruciating pain in his head. Mentally, he explored his body, trying to determine where it was presently located and the extent of the damage inflicted upon it. Slowly, he came to understand that he lay on his back with his arms tucked at his sides and his legs together. Several small, sharp objects dug into his buttocks and the backs of his thighs. He didn't stir, trying to isolate and identify everything he heard, smelled, tasted, or felt. He decided to check out his vision last, not wanting to open his eyes until he was sure of where he was and what was happening. After a few moments of lying completely still, he grudgingly realized he had no choice but to accept the fact that he had no idea in hell of what was going on. What he could identify was the cawing and screeching of gulls and the rhythmic boom of the surf. The dull ache in his left arm was the result of blocking a blow. Small rocks, most likely, pressed into his backside, so that meant he lay outside. He felt a stiffness in his face, a bruise throbbing along the right side of his jaw, spreading out from the side of his head. The rest of his anatomy possessed the general feeling of having been methodically pounded with a sledgehammer. Kane remembered only vaguely how his body had come to feel like a tenderized steak. His primary recollection of the attack was its savage speed, the quick rush of bodies, angry grunts, blinding pain in the side of his head like a drill punch boring in, and then the sensation of falling. He had no idea of how long he'd been unconscious. He, Grant, and Bridget Baptiste had come a long way over the past couple of days, and the meeting at the Cove was supposed to be the culmination of the journey from Montana to the Northern California coast. His eyes stung from sweat collected in pools in their sockets. The heat was intense, but the temperature gave him some idea of the time. The sun had just begun to rise when he'd walked down toward the shoreline for the rendezvous. Respiration labored. He wondered why, if he was lying outside, the air seemed so thick and stuffy, and why it required such effort to drag it into his straining lungs. By fractions of centimeters, he slitted his eyes open, then squinted against a confusing pattern of interlocked light and shadow. After a second or two of blinking, the pattern came into focus, and he realized a bag of burlap material covered his head. Heart pounding from a surge of claustrophobia, he resisted the desperate impulse to reach up and snatch the bag away. He continued to lie still. Patience was a habit instilled in him during his magistrate training, and later pounded into him by experience, and the often grim object lessons of comrades and enemies who failed to practice it.
Hardly an auspicious beginning. Partly my fault. I hope you don't hold it against me.
Kane didn't move or otherwise react, despite the spurt of adrenaline the voice triggered. Although a gambler and percentage player by nature, a calculator of risks and safety factors, Kane retained vivid memories of the consequences of his own unrestrained moments of impulse. Most of those moments were commemorated by the scar tissue imprinted on various parts of his body.
I know you're conscious. You can get up. You're not tied.
Kane considered the man's words, then slowly reached up and peeled the stifling bag up and off of his head. His right arm felt unnervingly light, and he realized his sin eater had been removed. He pushed himself to a sitting position, setting his teeth on a groan of pain. The movement ignited little hot flares all over his body. He flinched away from the blinding glare of the sun, hot as any dawn could possibly be on the shores of the stretch of Northern California coastline once called Crescent City. He glimpsed gulls wheeling on outspread wings, riding on the thermal currents arising from the juncture of the beach and the thundering sea. They soared gracefully through the smoky spume raised by the nearby breakers. He saw very little except sand, rocks, and the long line of combers smashing against boulders draped in seaweed. As Kane glanced down, he saw a pair of shiny white shoes planted firmly in the sand near his own booted feet. His gaze slowly climbed from the shoes to a pair of denim-clad legs and then up to the man's face, smiling down at him. It was a very handsome face, topped by longish, carefully styled black hair and adorned with a neatly trimmed, waxed mustache. His eyelashes were unusually long and delicately curved, veiling a pair of limpid brown eyes. His face bore a deep bronze tint, but Kane suspected the tan didn't derive from lying on the beach, but from regular exposure to a sun lamp. He wore a blue yachting blazer with an elaborate crest embroidered on the breast pocket, and in his right hand he held a tiny battery-operated fan with plastic vanes. Kane repressed a snort of derision. Breeze Castiglione didn't look like the boss of the Snakefish Barony's Tartarus pits. In fact, he didn't look like the boss of much of anything, unless it was a clothes closet. Still, though he should have looked ridiculous in his boating ensemble, for some reason Kane could not quite identify, he did not. Kane shook his head to clear it, opened his mouth, and worked his aching jaw.
You were right. Hardly an auspicious beginning. But you were wrong when you said it was partly your fault. In my opinion, it was entirely your fault.
You objected to being searched, Mr. Kane.
I objected to being felt up by that gimp of yours. Where is he?
See for yourself.
Kane followed the wave of Castiglione's perfectly manicured hand, slowly turning around on the rock-strewed sand. The man he had referred to as a gimp sat placidly on a low boulder behind him, huge hands resting on his knees. He was nearly 6.5 feet tall. His complexion was about the color of a charcoal briquette. One finger was missing from his right hand, and part of an ear had been cut from the left side of his shaved head. That side of his face was bisected by a crooked, puckered wheel that lifted the corner of his mouth up in a permanent grin. His left eye looked as if it was covered by a gray film. His chest was broad enough to force his arms out at the elbows. He breathed through his mouth because of the mashed condition of his nose. Blood flowed from both nostrils, soaking his white t-shirt with a random pattern of crimson.
My compliments. You're the first man I've ever known who made Belvedere bleed.
Do I get a prize for that or what?
Not from me, Sekman. I would have ended up the same as him, but I was just a little too fast for you.
Carefully, Kane hitched around. Her accent sounded just a little too strong.
Meet Tashlin.
Tashlin stood about 2 yards away, leaning negligently against a rock. She wore a sleeveless black silk tunic with a mandarin collar. Below its gold-edged hem, she had nothing on but a G-string, a black patent leather V gleaming at the juncture of her thighs. A pair of black net stockings covered her long, muscular legs. The boots on her feet bore high stiletto heels, and Kane recalled the drill-punch sensation in the side of his head, but he decided the time wasn't right to raise the issue. Her hips tapered to a tiny waist. The curves above her waist were ample, even attractively lush, but the same could not be said about her face. A coat of chalk-white makeup had been applied thickly to her skin, as well as vivid red lipstick and 2 perfect circles of a crimson cosmetic on her cheeks. Her eyes, which stared unblinkingly at him from between 2 wings of glossy midnight blue hair, were outlined with enough black mascara to paint a sand cat. False eyelashes, long enough to sweep clean the beach, fluttered like spider legs in the light breeze. Her penciled eyebrows, angled to form a pair of diabolical arches, completed her look. Tashlin would have appeared hilarious to Kane if he had seen her in a barony or even an outland vill. But standing here in her rig in the bright glare of the early morning sunlight, with salt spray forming a faint vapor around her, she exuded an air of the demonic. In her right hand, she held a long-handled club, a flexible truncheon nearly 2 feet long made of cross-stitched leather, with one end as big around as his fist. He guessed it was filled with buckshot, and he figured its vigorous use was responsible for giving his body the overall feeling of being hammered. In her left hand, she held his sin-eater, still snug within its power holster.
2 strong arms from 2 different directions. You don't like to take any chances, do you?
Actually, I do, but not with a man of your accomplishments and reputation. In dealing with you, I'd be a fool to be anything other than overcautious. Your fame, or your infamy, has spread far.
I'm on the level.
That remains to be seen. You may get up now.
But do it slowly.
Kane did as she said, not because she intimidated him, but because his head swam dizzily when he moved too quickly. He climbed to his feet, silently enduring a spasm of pain mixed with a little vertigo. He was aware of Tashlin looking him up and down, but he made a casual show of brushing sand from his clothes and arms. Pretending to massage the right side of his head, he gingerly felt for the contact, the flat curve of metal behind his ear and hidden by a lock of hair. Not hearing any voices or even a crackle of static since rousing, he had assumed the little comm unit had been damaged in the attack. Now he realized it wasn't there.
Looking for this?
Sunlight winked from the small bronze-hued curve of metal he bounced gently on his right palm. Kane didn't respond, gazing at the little device. Castiglione chuckled and tossed it toward him. Despite his surprise, Kane snatched it out of the air.
Tashlin came across it by accident when you were searched, Kane. She removed it just to be on the safe side.
Do you know what it is?
Not exactly, but I assume it's some sort of comm. I didn't want you sending or receiving messages from your companions until I had the chance to make sure you weren't carrying anything we couldn't deal with. As I said, overcautious.
To a fault.
Kane glanced past Tashlin, his eyes following a trail of glistening pebbles at the shoreline. They led to a crowded labyrinth of black rotting timbers half a click away. The bright morning sunlight made the ancient marina look unreal, like a stage setting. Through the open boathouses, he saw the partly submerged and barnacle-covered hulks of ships. Beyond the dock massed a number of seagoing craft, most of them dating back to the years immediately preceding the nuke cost. He saw sailboats, cabin cruisers, and even a few barges. Only a few vessels floated high in the water. At least half of the derelicts were waterlogged and nearly submerged, little more than mounds of jetsam rising from the surface of the sea. Some were canted on their sides. Others were capsized completely.
Interesting how you're able to get out of the pits to conduct business. Does Baron Snakefish mind that his pit boss leaves Tartarus unattended?
Named after the abyss below hell where Zeus had confined his enemies, the Tartarus pits were the planned slums of the baronies, melting pots swarming with slaggers and cheap labor. Many years before, the barons had decreed that the Vils could support no more than 4,000 residents, and the number of pit dwellers could not exceed 1,000. Part of every magistrate's duty was to make pit sweeps, seeking outlanders, infants, and even pregnant women, and either ejecting them from the barony or killing them. Despite the ruthless treatment of the pit dwellers, one constant in all of the 9 Vils was a pit boss. By no means an official title or position, pit bosses nevertheless served a purpose of varying degrees of importance depending on the vill. Part crime lords, part information conduits, and part procurers of luxuries, most barons tolerated pit bosses as long as they knew and kept their place. If they maintained a certain order among the seething masses in Tartarus, magistrates were inclined to overlook limited black marketeering or the elimination of troublesome elements. Not only did Breeze Castiglione not look anything like a Tartarus resident, but he also didn't resemble any pit boss Kane had ever met. But Kane knew Castiglione hadn't risen to prominence in the Tartarus pits of Snakefish on his looks and fey manner alone. He possessed a cunning and absolutely ruthless brain, which in tandem with his talent for manipulation and unlawful acquisition of goods made him something of a genius. He had also, in the very recent past, somehow managed to smuggle a great number of death-dealing ordnance out of the magistrate armory and into the possession of an old enemy of Kane's. The old enemy was dead now, or so Kane fervently hoped, but the mystery of how Castiglione had accomplished the deed, and whether he could repeat it, remained to be resolved.
Do you think we can get down to business now?
Sure. Tashlin, my sidearm, if you please.
The woman's painted lips curled back over her teeth in a theatrical sneer.
In your dreams, Sekman.
Sekman was an obsolete term dating back to pre-unification days, when self-styled barons formed their own private armies to safeguard their territories. It was still applied to magistrates in the hinterlands beyond the Vils, so Kane figured Tashlin was a native of the Outlands, not Russia. The accent was an affectation, probably an imitation of one she had heard in an old vid dealing with spies or vampires. Still, Kane didn't like the term. Even though he was no longer a magistrate, he still considered it an insult, but he didn't allow the anger building within him to show on his face.
I'm not dreaming, Tashlin. Give me back my gun, or I'll take it from you. Belvedere, notwithstanding.
He took a menacing half-step toward her, and Castiglione interjected.
I'd prefer you weren't armed during the initial phase of our negotiations.
Kane spun toward him, mouth opening to voice a profane rejoinder. The rejoinder clogged momentarily in his throat when he saw Breeze Castiglione had exchanged his miniature fan for what appeared to be a miniature pistol. The auto derringer wasn't really miniature, and its stainless steel frame made it look very businesslike. He guessed the pistol was an old Semmering American derringer, loaded with a single but nevertheless deadly .38 caliber round. Kane forced a mocking smile to his face and held up the contact.
You didn't want me sending any messages to my companions with this, right? Well, since my companions haven't heard from me in a while, I'm sure they're on their way here.
Kane waved toward dense stands of sycamore trees about half a mile away, the trunks snarled with undergrowth.
Hell, they may even be watching us right now.
Castiglione glanced toward the trees, but he said nothing.
If they see me standing here with your painted-up gaudy slut holding my gun, and you with a gun on me, there won't be a single solitary phase of negotiations at all, initial or otherwise.
I see. Then I suggest you contact them with your comm unit and let them know everything is under control. That is, if you actually have companions anywhere around.
Well, gee. You mean you want me to lie to them? Won't my pants catch on fire? You claimed my reputation made you overcautious. If you know that much about me, then you know my reputation is shared with a couple of other people, right?
Right.
Then I would think you'd want to be triply overcautious. I showed my good faith when I met up with you alone, at dawn. In my estimation, it would be an exceptionally good idea for you to show yours.
Tashlin stepped forward, holding her truncheon aggressively.
Ha! You're bluffing, sick man! Fuck your reputation. Even if you're who you say you are, I don't think you have any friends anyplace. You're just another fugitive from the Barrens with a price on your...
The shot could not have been timed better. Though it was a poor shot for Grant, Kane figured the round had been fired from the big Barrett sniper rifle strictly for effect. The effect was immediate. Belvedere rose from his boulder with a grunt of surprise. Teshlin skipped backward, nearly tripping over her own feet. Only Breeze Castiglione didn't move. His frown molded itself into a resigned smile. He placed the derringer in his blazer pocket and held out both hands toward Teshlin.
Give Mr. Kane his gun, Tasha, sweetheart. We don't want him or his companions to think we're unfriendly.
The chalk and vermilion-faced woman hesitated for a moment. Then she hissed in disgust and tossed the power holster. Kane caught it easily in his left hand. With his right, he fitted the contact back into place behind his ear.
Now, when I tell them everything is under control, it will be the truth.
Grant pushed aside a leafy bush and scanned the beach with somber, dark brown eyes. Their color seemed more of an angry, dangerous black in the mottled sunlight. He held his head as if he were listening for something other than the squawking of seabirds and the boom of the surf. He kept the stock of the heavy Barrett rifle jammed firmly against his right shoulder and his finger resting on the trigger guard. He gazed steadily through the 20-power telescopic sight at the four figures outlined sharply against the beige sand and blue sea. The dazzling light reflecting from the ocean in a glimmering wave pattern forced him to squint.
What's going on?
Grant didn't remove his gaze from the scope to glance over at Bridget Baptiste, lying on her stomach beside him, but peering through a compact pair of binoculars.
I don't really know, but it looks like my 50-cal calling card has made everybody a lot more friendly. Kane has his sin-eater back.
Droplets of perspiration sparkled against his coffee-brown skin like stars in a night sky. His own sin-eater was strapped securely in its power holster around his right forearm.
And it looks like Kane is fiddling with his contact. He doesn't seem to be seriously injured.
An Ivor Johnson TP-9 auto pistol hung in a slide-draw holster at her hip, and a copperhead close-assault subgun was slung from a strap around her shoulder.
If he is hurt, I think he gave as good as he got.
I don't like the looks of that big guy, though. He seems a little put out with Kane.
Yeah, but Kane has that effect on most people, if you haven't noticed.
She grinned bleakly, continuing to study the scene through the binoculars. Grant shifted the Barrett, pushing the rifle forward on the built-in bipod, settling the buttstock firmly in the hollow of his shoulder. Chambered to take 50-caliber ammo, the weapon possessed massive recoil, which only made sense since it had been introduced 2 centuries before to take out armored targets and blast holes through concrete walls. A burst of static filled his head, and then he heard Kane's voice echoing inside his skull.
Testing. 1, 2, 3. Testing.
Got you. Calibrate the pickup for Bridget, too.
My contact is already calibrated. Reading you, Kane.
As you may already know, I've been formally welcomed by Boss Breeze Castiglione at his Chamber of Commerce.
So we see. Are you all right?
I got slapped around a little while Breeze verified my bona fides, but nothing's been knocked too loose. You're here a little earlier than I figured.
When we lost contact with you, we decided not to wait with the Jeep and came down to find out what was happening. We've only been here about 5 minutes.
You timed it just fine.
Through the scope and the binoculars, Grant and Bridget watched him turn in their general direction and wave.
Breeze wants you to come on down. There's no reason to hide anymore.
Is it safe?
As far as I can tell.
If it's not safe, if you think it's a trap, wave twice.
Kane didn't wave.
I think we're all right for the time being.
Bridget adjusted the focus of the binoculars, trying to bring the four figures on the shore into sharper relief. She swallowed a yawn, tired from the past few days of the hard overland journey from the Darks. Even traveling by Jeep, one of the several vehicles that were part of the Cerberus rolling stock, the trip was difficult. However, she reminded herself, the journey itself was less difficult than getting word to Breeze Castiglione he had buyers for his merchandise. If the potential customer hadn't been Kane, he would have no doubt refused the meeting out of hand, suspecting that Baron Snakefish might be pulling a sting. Bridget didn't know much about the Vill of Snakefish, or the Baron who had taken its unique and grotesque name as his own, except that he had participated in the Siege of Cobaltville during the so-called Imperator War. All of the 9 baronies in the continent-spanning network were standardized, so there probably wasn't much to know. However, Snakefish possessed a certain historical significance, inasmuch as it had been an important commerce center on the Scific coast in the century following Skydark. Although roughly half the state of California lay beneath the sea, the region around the Ville had received only a light once-over with neutron bombs. Much of the mammalian life was killed off, but many of the structures remained standing. Several of the structures were part of a gasoline processing complex, which in the decades following the Holocaust made Snakefish one of the wealthiest Villes in the country, at least by the standards of Deathlands. Other than having access to a resource that was more precious than gold, the Ville was the birthplace of a bizarre religious sect that worshipped the giant muti rattlesnakes in the area. The religion, and the source of the Ville's wealth, vanished at about the same time when sabotage caused the fuel refinery to explode. The Ville itself burned to the ground, taking with it a good number of its 2,000 inhabitants. One of the few survivors was determined to rebuild the Ville, to restore its former glory as the primary power on the far western coast. During the process, he took the name of Snakefish for himself. By the time of the Program of Unification, the new Ville of Snakefish, although scarcely as prosperous as its predecessor, was a power to be reckoned with. It and its baron were absorbed into the ruling baronial oligarchy.
It probably makes more tactical sense to drop the three of those slaggers in their tracks.
Probably, but it's a little difficult to cut a deal with corpses.
Bridget could sense Kane's suppressed smile, even if she couldn't see it clearly. The painted woman with her ridiculous clothing made her shiver, while the huge black man with the bloody nose made her queasy.
Who are those other two with Castiglione?
The big man is Belvedere. The woman is Tashlin. Breeze calls her Tasha. They just want to know who they're dealing with before they come out. Breeze wanted to know why I told you that.
Grant pushed himself to his knees, pulling the sniper rifle to him and folding up the bipod.
Tell him we're on our way.
He slid the rifle into its felt-lined leather carrying case and zipped it shut, then rose, angling it over a shoulder. Bridget climbed to her feet and checked her pistol to be sure it was loose enough in the holster to be drawn easily, but not so loose it would fall out if they had to start moving fast.
Ready?
Not really, but when has that ever made a difference?
Grant pushed aside the foliage and stepped out. He and Bridget marched deliberately away from the tree line toward the four figures silhouetted against the bright blue of the Scific. They both put on sunglasses to protect their vision from the shimmering glare. Bridget briefly wished she and Grant had packed out more ordnance from the jeep, but she tried to convince herself that Gren's and other firearms wouldn't be necessary. As it was, the vehicle was parked beneath a canopy of camouflage netting nearly 5 miles to their rear.
Do you think we can trust them?
According to what we learned while we were in Ultima Thule, Castiglione supplied some of the material that Sakat used when he tried to loosen the Antarctic ice sheet. So, what do you think?
Kane heard both the question and response, but he wisely refrained from offering his opinion. When Grant and Bridget walked to within a score of yards of the four people, Breeze Castiglione all but ignored her, but flicked his appreciative gaze up and down Grant's massive frame.
The boss likes big men.
And really painted up ladies, too. No accounting for taste.
She sub-vocalized, so only Grant and Kane could hear her. But apparently, the woman guessed her remark was disparaging, and she fixed Bridget with a venomous stare. Bridget, her eyes masked by the dark lenses of sunglasses, kept her expression blandly neutral. Castiglione flashed the two newcomers a toothy, welcoming grin.
Former Magistrate Grant and ex-archivist Bridget Baptiste, the other two components of the much-discussed Triumvirate of Terror. It's a great honor to meet all of you.
We're here to do business, not to be honored.
Of course, but we can be civilized while we're doing it.
He turned and waved an arm toward the distant dock stretching out from the marina. Almost immediately, a dinghy swung around the far end of it, riding on the swells. Only one man appeared to be aboard, sitting in the stern and piloting the craft in their direction. Kane estimated the boat to be around 12 feet long, just barely big enough in beam and length to accommodate the six of them.
We need a boat to look at the merchandise?
We do indeed. How else do you think I've managed to keep it hidden from Baron Snakefish's foxhounds for so long?
I assume you mean his magistrates.
Of course.
The dinghy motored into the shallows, foam frothing from the prow, and the pilot cut the engine. He was a middle-aged, seam-faced man with the raw-boned look of an outlander. Everyone, Castiglione included, waded out and climbed aboard the dinghy. As Kane estimated, the fit was tight, particularly after Belvedere hauled himself into the craft. Despite the cramped quarters, Kane was encouraged, since almost no maneuvering room remained. Of course, he reminded himself sourly, that could turn out to be a double-edged sword. Brigid, jammed up beside him, hip and thigh, gingerly touched the contusion discoloring the right side of his head. The brine made it feel raw and sticky.
You sure you're okay?
Just the usual post-ambush concussion. Really, I'm fine.
He tried to smile, and she returned it with a weary one of her own, then glanced away. Kane guessed she recalled the serious head injury she had suffered less than a year before. The only visible sign of the wound that had laid her scalp open to the bone and put her in a coma for several days was a faintly red horizontal line on her right temple that disappeared into the roots of her hair. Her recovery time had been just short of uncanny. Kane was always impressed by the woman's steel spring resiliency. The pilot restarted the engine with a yank of the cord and turned the boat back toward the marina. He gunned the engine, the dinghy bouncing roughly on the chop, until Breeze ordered him to ease up on the throttle. Instead of tying up at the pier or within one of the boathouses, the dinghy rounded the berths and navigated among the derelicts. Many of the old craft were little more than algae and barnacle-encrusted hulks. The masts of sailboats rose from the sea like a forest of defoliated trees. Other vessels appeared relatively intact, and some of the larger wrecks were pressed closely together. Gangplanks made of lashed timbers joined them to one another. The dinghy chugged under the bow of a half-sunken, rust-pimpled old steamer and pulled alongside an ancient barge. It was secured to another barge by a bridge made of welded lengths of anchor chain. The broad deck of the barge was piled high with all manner of flotsam and jetsam, sticks, seaweed, logs, old fuel barrels, and just about every conceivable kind of trash. Kane gazed speculatively at the collection of debris, and his keen senses rang an alarm. The skin between his shoulder blades seemed to tighten, and the short hairs at the back of his neck tingled. What he called his point man sense was really a combined manifestation of the five he had, trained to the epitome of sharpness. The pattern of garbage seemed a bit too mannered, not as haphazard as on the first casual glance. Looking up into the azure sky, he imagined what the graveyard of ships and the barge might look like to the pilot of a death bird. He decided it would look pretty much the same from the air as it did from the boat, uninhabited and uninhabitable. The hull of the dinghy bumped against the side of the barge. Moving swiftly, without having to be ordered, Belvedere tied the boat to a stanchion and the pilot cut the engine. Breeze Castiglione gestured expansively to the barge.
Mi casa es su casa.
You expect us to believe you live here?
You might say it's my oceanside resort.
Brigid, Grant, and Kane clambered aboard the barge. They made no move to help Castiglione or his crew disembark, nor had they been asked to do so. Grant surveyed the detritus on the barge's deck.
The merchandise?
Castiglione marched across the deck toward an upended oil drum and a tall framework of rusty angle iron.
Belvedere, come here.
Belvedere hustled swiftly forward, falling into step behind the mustached man. Tashlin and the dinghy's pilot lingered near the three outlanders, but Kane figured their proximity didn't derive from enjoyment of their company. Belvedere heaved away the fuel barrel, revealing a drum and winch assembly bolted to the deck. A heavy hemp hawser was wound around the drum. At the same time, Castiglione kicked aside a scattering of rotted canvas and lifted a long but slim I-beam from the deck. He fitted it in the framework as a crossbar. A block and tackle dangled from its center. Brigid, Grant, and Kane watched with keen interest as Castiglione took the end of the rope, which was tipped by a metal hook, and pulled out a dozen or so feet of slack. He threaded it through the pulley system and kneeled over a staple-shaped handle protruding from the deck. Belvedere picked up a cold-rolled iron crank handle and inserted the flanged end into the notches at the side of a drum. At a nod from Castiglione, he began to vigorously turn it. The rope went taut, and the crossbar sagged, creaking a little under a great weight.
What the hell is this now?
A circular steel enclosure slowly rose from below the barge deck. As Belvedere hoisted it out foot by foot, they saw that it resembled a steel cylinder about 7 feet long and 4 feet in diameter. Castiglione gestured, waving them over.
You'll be among the very few who ever actually peeked into my Vault of Wonder.
Vault of Wonder? What's so wonderful about blasters and grins?
I suppose that depends on your definition of magic.
As the tube slowly cleared the metal collared opening in the deck, Bridget eyed it closely, noting an almost invisible seam running from top to bottom and a series of tiny hinges. She also saw that its surface was not damp or streaked with rust, so the vault's hiding place, although below the waterline, was not actually in the water. Sweat poured down Belvedere's face as he labored, cutting runnels through the dried blood on his chin. Kane did not allow himself to relax. He cast a casual over-the-shoulder glance toward Tashlin. Her body language was broadcasting tension. She absently tapped the truncheon against the side of her leg. It occurred to Kane that he hadn't tested the action of his Sin-Eater's power holster since Tashlin had returned it to him. She could have disabled the actuator mechanism while he'd lain unconscious. He cut his eyes over to Grant. His Sin-Eater was strapped securely to his right forearm, but he held the Barrett inside its zipped-up case angled over his shoulder. If circumstances changed quickly, as they often did in the Outlands, then Grant would expend precious seconds freeing up his gun hand. The best bet, if matters took an ugly turn, would be Bridget Baptiste's copperhead. Less than 2 feet long, with a 700-round-per-minute rate of fire, the magazine held 15 4.85-millimeter steel-jacketed rounds. The grip and trigger unit were placed in front of the breech in the bullpup design, allowing for one-handed use. An optical image intensifier scope and laser auto-targeter were fitted on the top of the frame. Its low recoil allowed the copperhead to be fired in a long, devastating full-auto burst. All of the Cerberus exiles were required to become reasonably proficient with firearms, and the lightweight point-and-shoot subguns were the easiest for the firearm challenge to handle. Belvedere hoisted the steel cylinder a foot or so clear of the deck's surface and held it in position, his biceps bulging as if they might burst. The boatman came forward and wrestled the enclosure away from the opening, and Belvedere gave the crank a half-reverse turn, bringing it to rest gently on its flat bottom. Breeze Castiglione ran his hands over the surface.
Be prepared to have your mind staggered and your eyes dazzled.
We better have something after all the trouble we went to.
Castiglione threw him a fleeting smile as he touched the cylinder. The curved side facing them swung outward on its hinges. Breeze stepped back, pulling it with him.
Abracadabra!
Two magistrates in full body armor stepped out of the cylinder, boars of their Sin-Eaters trained directly on Bridget, Grant, and Kane.
Hey, presto.
Everybody looked at each other as if in a tableau. As surreptitiously as he could manage, Kane flexed the tendons of his right wrist. The big board automatic hand blaster had no trigger guards or safety, and the pistol would fire immediately upon the touch of his crooked index finger. The sensitive actuator ignored all movements except the one that indicated the weapon should be drawn. Nothing happened, as Kane had halfway expected. Either the tiny electric motor or the actuator had been disabled.
Nobody move. Don't even breathe deep. That includes you and your crew, Castiglione.
Kane, Bridget, and Grant obeyed the order, all of them knowing that even if they squeezed off the first shots, the body armor would protect the magistrates from serious injury.
Back up. Keep backing up until I tell you to stop.
The three did as they were told, and the magistrates stepped out of the enclosure. The armored man who gave the orders exuded an air of detached professionalism, not resorting to bombastic threats or gloating speeches. He was a little over medium size with the thick, square body of a man who intimately knew the ways of close and bloody combat. Kane and Grant guessed he was probably a veteran officer of some authority. As a general rule, only inexperienced rank-and-file mags acted like sadistic thugs, little better than the sec men pejorative applied to them.
Stop now! Castiglione, take Grant's rifle and Baptiste's copperhead.
Kane experienced a brief surge of surprise, but he realized in retrospect it would have been more surprising if the man hadn't recognized them. He and his two friends had topped the barony's most wanted lists for some time now, particularly after the assassination of Baron Ragnar nearly 2 years before. Tales of the renegade's exploits circulated through the Outlands, giving rise not only to rebellious thoughts, but also to outright acts of resistance. To kill a baron was tantamount to killing a god. And if a god could be assassinated by mortal hands, then the tyranny of the nine barons could no longer be maintained. Breeze Castiglione opened his mouth as if to object to the mag's order, but turned to Tashlin.
Tasha, get their weapons and...
No, I told you to do it, pit boss.
Castiglione swallowed hard, his face paling by several shades under the tan. Reluctantly, he stepped forward and took hold of the leather-encased Barrett leaning against Grant's right shoulder. Studiously avoiding eye contact, Breeze took the weapon and then moved over to Bridget. She relinquished her subgun without a murmur of protest or the flicker of an eyelash. Castiglione slid away, relieved that his trim body was no longer in front of two sin-eaters. He handed the rifle to Tashlin, but kept the copperhead.
Grant, Kane, I want you to remove your sidearms. Just drop them.
Kane and Grant hesitated, and the bore of the mag's pistol shifted to Bridget.
Must I make an example of her?
Both men instantly realized he wasn't running a bluff. Doing as they were told, they unbuckled the straps and unfastened the Velcro tabs on the power holsters. They let them thump to the deck at their feet.
Very good, gentlemen.
You have the advantage of us.
Which is quite a feat from what I hear. My name is Hauk. This is Loxley.
With one hand, the mag undid the underjaw locking guards of his helmet and tugged it off his head. Loxley kept his on. Hauk's face was that of a man in the prime of his life, a hard life. His features were regular and unexceptional. If not for the deep cicatrix scar creasing his left cheek from the corner of his gray eye to his chin, he wouldn't have drawn any attention in a crowded room. His blonde hair was pulled back and knotted at the nape of his neck.
Does my name mean anything to you?
You're the Snakefish Magistrate Division Administrator. Or you used to be.
Very good.
Absently, Kane noted that Hauk's hair wasn't quite regulation length. But he also knew that Ville Division administrators were allowed a certain leeway with the rules, as long as they performed their jobs to the Baron's satisfaction. Hauk also looked a shade too young to be a division administrator, no more than 35 or 40. But then Kane had never gained a truly clear understanding of the criteria by which such transfers were granted. Although magistrates were legally allowed to marry and to produce legitimate offspring only when they held an administrative post, being appointed as an administrator in any of the Ville divisions wasn't exactly a promotion, nor was the transfer completely based on age. The quality of service was the most important consideration. Kane could only assume that Hauk had personally involved himself in their apprehension because Baron Snakefish might have been disappointed in the quality of his service as of late. Recalling the sinking of the Baron's beloved and virtually irreplaceable CG-47 cruiser in the Bay of Nuedo, as well as the loss of its entire crew of mags, Kane wasn't surprised by Hauk's presence. Although Baron Snakefish had ordered the attack on Nuedo, he certainly held the Magistrate Division Commander responsible for its success or failure.
You're probably wondering why a Mag Division Administrator is out here participating in the apprehension of three renegades.
Actually, I'm pretty sure we can guess.
Really? Do tell.
Back during the Imperator War, we three caused you and your Baron a big loss in men and ordnance. I imagine your Ville's armory was pretty well cleaned out after the Battle of Area 51 and the Siege of Cobaltville.
The same could be said for a couple of other baronies, too.
Yeah, but I doubt any other barony suffered the loss of a pre-dark battlecruiser with all hands. After that disaster, you were either disciplined by Baron Snakefish or removed from your position. Either way, you need to get back into his good graces, and there's no better way than to bring in the three of us in shackles.
You're pretty damn close. You're off a bit on a couple of points, but they're minor. Overall, you've pegged the situation correctly. I almost forgot you and Kane used to be mags yourselves.
We haven't.
I give the specific order to have you three hunted down. That's the important thing.
The old, if you want something done right, thing?
Something like that.
You weren't the first Mag Division Administrator to give an order like that. And you're not the first Mag Division Administrator to come after us personally.
For the past several years, all of the nine Villes in the continent-spanning network had engaged in a cooperative search for the three of them. The search had concentrated mainly in the old military redoubts scattered across the face of America. The subterranean installations, constructed two centuries before to house the most advanced scientific miracles of the day, had been sealed for generations since the program of unification. Over the past year or so, the redoubts located in Ville territories had been methodically visited and inspected by the respective baron's magistrates. More than one redoubt had shown signs of occupation, as if the quarry had known it was being sought and had moved from redoubt to redoubt to escape capture and to confuse the trail.
I can understand that Breeze got word to you about us contacting him to arrange a buy of his merchandise, but I can't understand why he did it, or what he hopes to get out of it.
Last question first, since it's the easiest. Breeze, you can feel that one, slagger.
Castiglione shuffled his feet uncomfortably.
My life.
That's what I get out of selling you to Baron Snakefish. My life and those of my strong arms.
Straightforward enough, and pretty much what all of us expected to hear. What's the rest of it, Hauk?
Hauk's frozen facial muscles finally displayed a hint of emotion. His lips curled in a sneer.
We had the Mag go renegade, Kane. That's something you should be able to relate to. Goes by the name of Chaffee. When the Baron was trying to restock the Ville's armory, like you said, we lost a lot of ordnance over the last 6 months. I assigned Chaffee to inventory and restocking detail. He decided he didn't like the detail, didn't like being a mag, and didn't like living in the Ville anymore. So he started selling arms to Breeze here, because Breeze fed him a line about arranging a new life in a new place for him.
I see. You assigned the mags to come after us, and then you assigned Chaffee to the armory. Yeah, I can see where the Baron might start wondering about your powers of judgment, particularly when the Ville's armory is involved.
Every one of the 9 Villes possessed a huge storage facility secured behind a massive vanadium alloy sector. Each was filled with enough death-dealing ordnance to outfit a mid-size army. Only direct voice authorization from Baron Snakefish would allow admittance into the vault. The planners of the old COG, Continuity of Government, programs had prudently recognized that, unlike food, medicine, and clothing, technology, particularly weapons, if kept sheltered, would endure the test of time and last generation after generation. Arms and equipment of every sort had been placed in deep storage locations all over the United States, within vaults filled with nitrogen gas to maintain below-freezing temperatures. Some survivors of the nuke cost and their descendants had carved out lucrative careers looting and trading the contents of the stockpiles. When the program of unification was instituted nearly a century before, one of the fundamental agreements had been that the people must be disarmed and the remaining stockpiles secured. Of course, to institute this action, the barons and their security forces not only had to be better armed than the outland hordes, but they also had to know the locations of the stockpiles. The barons were provided with both, and far more.
Chaffee got sloppy and left a trail, which I followed to the Tartarus pits and Breeze. He couldn't tell me where Chaffee and all the materiel had gotten to, but as perfect timing would have it, he told me that Kane had just gotten word to him about being in the market for stolen ordnance. And I knew where there was Kane, I'd probably find Grant and Baptiste too.
Yes, I'd say that is pretty perfect timing for you. Pretty lousy for us.
My question is how you knew about what Breeze and Chaffee were doing.
There's nothing mysterious about it. Chaffee's allies told me about Breeze's little experiment in Free Enterprise.
I see. And how did you come to know Chaffee's allies? Where are they? Where is he?
Beyond your or anybody's reach. We were told by a reliable authority that he's dead. He was double-crossed and killed.
That figures. And it's fitting. I have a lot more questions. A whole lot more. But they can keep until you're all in the interrogation cells on E-level.